I next met with molecular geneticist Dr. Mark Ladani, and to begin, he commented on the issue of histology in defining treatment of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
The distinction between squamous and adenoid can be difficult, especially on small biopsies. So there will be cases in which either you won't be able to get that distinction. They'll be signed out by the pathologist as non-small cell, not otherwise specified. Or you'll have a situation where the biopsy was read as squamous, but when the tumor comes out at surgery, you realize it's an adenosquamous. And we've learned that adenosquamous cancers actually have the mutational profile more typical of adenocarcinoma. So there are situations where if you get a non-small cell NOS or squamous on a biopsy, you still have to have at the back of your mind the possibility that this patient could have the adenocarcinoma alterations that could be targeted.
We also looked into the kind of assays that these investigators are utilizing. And of course, most of them are using some type of NGS, but in terms of defining first-line therapy, it seemed that now that's becoming a little bit of a moving target. In the past, it was kind of EGFR, ALK, ROS1, but now we're starting to see investigators talking about using first-line targeted therapy with BRAF and MET. Any thoughts about the issue of getting results back of assays like this in time to make a decision for first-line treatment of metastatic disease?
Yeah, so what you're bringing up is the concern or the limitation of some of the more complex NGS assays in terms of turnaround time. So they often might take 2 or 3 weeks to get results, and people don't typically like waiting that long. That's one of the reasons why in our practice, we also have quick assays for EGFR and ALK alterations so that we can get an answer back within a few days. But I think as more targets move into first line, into FDA approval of as first line therapies, I think we're going to see more pressure to have broader quick assays that will give information quickly on these critical already approved targets. And then later, as a second test, a more comprehensive NGS panel. I think that's the way things are going.
Can you talk about your view of how the molecular pathology of lung cancer has evolved?
I think lung cancer's been really an amazing story because starting in 2004 with the discovery of EGFR mutations, we've seen this steady definition of further subsets of lung adenocarcinoma, most of them targetable with available agents, either in clinical trials or already FDA approved. So it's really become the poster child for targeted therapies in solid cancers. At the same time, more recently, it's become one of the major cancers in which immunotherapies are quite attractive. And the subset of lung adenocarcinoma in which immunotherapies are most effective is the subset that mostly was lacking targetable alterations. So it's almost like complementary in a very nice way. So one of the things to remember about these targetable genetic alterations in lung adenocarcinoma is that they tend to be quite mutually exclusive. So you typically see these pie charts that show the proportions of the different alterations. And the experience is the numbers might be a little bit different from center to center, but overall, what we're seeing for the percentage of cases, for instance, that have the alterations that you were asking about in the survey, namely EGFR, AL, RET, ROS fusions, BRAF, V600E, ERBB2 mutations, and MET exon 14 mutations, we're seeing about 35% of patients, of adenocarcinoma patients overall, with one of these targetable mutations. And I think the experience elsewhere, for instance, Dana-Farber, is very similar, around 30-35%.
Can you talk a little bit about your vision for what a driver mutation is and how you determine what a driver mutation is?
The term driver mutation can be used kind of loosely, basically as any cancer mutation or it can be used in a more kind of stringent fashion in the sense of a mitogenic driver. So if you look at the alterations in lung adenocarcinoma, the real targetable drivers are alterations that activate the MAP kinase signaling pathway. And the thinking is that you need to activate that pathway at one place in the pathway. And once you've done that, you don't need to activate it at other points in the pathway. So this is kind of the approach to using the term driver in lung adenocarcinoma. If a particular alteration that activates the MAP kinase pathway is mutually exclusive with EGFR and KRAS and so on, then it really tells you that that is a mitogenic driver that defines a molecular subset of lung adenocarcinoma.
So obviously, KRAS mutations are, you know, a very common finding. Can you talk a little bit about why it's been so difficult to find therapies for people with KRAS mutant disease?
KRAS is more difficult in terms of drug design. That's my understanding. I'm not a pharmacologist, but it has been more difficult in terms of drug design. There are now some compounds that specifically target certain mutant forms of KRAS. There are subsets of KRAS mutated lung adenos that do respond to MEK inhibition. We don't exactly understand which subset of KRAS that is. There are a lot of efforts, obviously, to develop therapies for KRAS mutated tumors. And I think it's only a matter of time until we see more and more of these patients eligible for targeted therapies. Although at the same time, I should mention that a big slice of KRAS mutated lung adenocarcinoma is smoking associated. A lot of the major KRAS mutations have the mutational signature of tobacco carcinogens. And as such, they tend to have higher mutational loads, which also makes them better candidates for immunotherapies. So there might be competing approaches for this subset of lung adenocarcinoma patients.
It's interesting. I've seen, of course, there's tons of data on mutational load, but is there any correlation between KRAS status and response to immune checkpoint inhibitors?
I wouldn't be able to quote you a study in particular, but I would not be surprised that patients with the smoking-associated KRAS mutations respond better because they also have a higher number of other mutations as well.
We were only really able to identify right now today 7 genomic alterations where we have targeted therapy that we see people utilizing targeted therapy. Yet, when you hear a lot of emphasis on multiplex testing, a lot of people reflex into next-gen sequencing, where you get tons and tons of information. But really, from a practical perspective, aside from research, you want to know about these 7 alterations. Would it make more sense to have a panel of these 7 alterations?
I think one could make an argument for that, for sure. I think you might want to have a upfront quick assay, which would be a multiplex NGS assay by necessity, because already this is a large number of genes and exons and so on. But you could have such a small quick panel up front and then do a broader panel as the follow-up test. But it really depends on, I guess, a number of factors. If your patient population really is not going to have access to clinical trials, then you could reason that it's really only useful to test for the currently targetable alterations. But there are other alterations which may be targetable that are being targeted in the context of clinical trials. And I think it's worthwhile to do that additional testing in case the patient can get connected to and eligible for something that's being targeted in a clinical trial elsewhere. So with ALK, RET, and ROS fusions, one of the challenges for molecular testing is that each of these kinases can rearrange with a whole number of other different partners to be turned on. So although EML4 is the main partner for ALK, there are also many other partners that have been described. ROS1 is even more varied in terms of its fusion partners. And what this means is that we can have just individual assays, EML4 ALK specifically, and some other fusion of ALK and so on. So our approaches, testing approaches, are designed to pick up any fusion involving one of these three genes. And historically, this was done by FISH, just looking for rearrangement of those genes. But now we're using different NGS methods, both DNA-based and RNA-based, to pick up any fusion involving these three kinases.
Could you explain at a medical student level how FISH assays are done?
Well, with FISH assays, and the most common form of FISH assay for these fusions is a so-called break-apart FISH assay. So basically, you have one FISH probe that binds at the beginning of the gene, and the other one binds at the end of the gene. And normally those two signals, which are different colors, should be next to each other. If you have a rearrangement and a fusion with a gene somewhere else in the genome, those two signals then are separated, and you can see that they're no longer contiguous, and you can diagnose a rearrangement that way. So that is certainly historically the most common way to pick up these rearrangements.
Let's talk about targetable tumor alterations. And one of the most recent in lung cancer has been MET exon 14 skipping alterations. Can you comment on what we know about these tumors?
Well, MET exon 14 skipping alterations are a very interesting story because it's something that was detected originally many years ago, but the exact significance and prevalence wasn't clear until quite recently. And one thing I think people should be aware of is that when you look at lung adenocarcinomas very comprehensively with NGS assays, you realize that MET exon 14 alterations are probably the third most common targetable alteration in lung adenocarcinoma behind EGFR and ALK. And they're actually, in our experience, more common than RET and ROS1 fusions. One of the challenges with MET exon 14 alterations is that the exon 14 skipping can be caused by a variety of mutations that affect the splice sites of exon 14. And what happens when exon 14 is skipped is that the exon 14 contains a region that is recognized by the cellular machinery that turns over the MET receptor tyrosine kinase. So when that exon is missing from MET, the receptor tyrosine kinase is not degraded and accumulates at the cell membrane, and there's this excessive signaling through the MET receptor tyrosine kinase down to the MAP kinase pathway. So it's an alteration that was underappreciated previously, but has really emerged as one of the significant targetable subsets of lung adenocarcinoma.
Can you differentiate that? I know in the past I've heard about MET amplification. What's the difference between that and these skipping alterations?
MET amplification, which means just increase in the number of copies of the MET gene per cell, is something that was the object of many studies previously. Once we figured out MET exon 14 alterations, we realized that the two often occur together. So the gene can undergo this MET exon 14 skipping and then get amplified. So some of the earlier studies that just looked at MET amplification, they had a combination of cases that included MET exon 14 cases and MET cases without mutations that were just amplified. Now that we can tease those two apart, we can also recognize that there is a small subset of lung adenocarcinomas that just have increased copies of the MET gene without any mutation of the MET gene. And those may also be potentially targetable if the amplification level is high enough. That's a subset, I think, that probably still needs a little bit more clarification.
Maybe you can comment a little bit on RET.
So RET fusions are seen, in our experience, in about 1% to 2% of lung adenocarcinomas. They do respond to RET inhibitors, but they do stand out a little bit among these targetable subsets of lung adenocarcinoma in that the response rate is lower than your typical response rate in EGFR and ALK and ROS1. The overall response rate was 28%, in contrast to the 60 to 80% response rates that you kind of expect when you have a targetable alteration and you treat it with a drug that hits the target. So there's been a lot of work, and there's a lot of work going on to figure out why these response rates for RET fusion lung cancers tend to be lower and how to improve them. I think that's still work in progress.
Any hypotheses that you find appealing?
There's a hypothesis that we haven't been using really good RET inhibitors yet, that some of the RET inhibitors that have been used are kind of dirty multi-targeted kinase inhibitors. There's also been some evidence that RET fusion lung cancers have a very active bypass signaling pathway available, so that when you block RET, the growth signaling via another pathway, such as EGFR, becomes active and compensates for the RET inhibition. So these are things people are working on right now, actually.
How about NTRK fusions?
Yeah, NTRK fusions. As I think most of us saw at ASCO recently, there are dramatic responses to NTRK inhibition in patients with NTRK fusions. NTRK fusions are, I wouldn't say unique, but they do have this particularity of occurring in a variety of different cancers. And in each individual cancer, except for a few very rare subtypes, they are seen in only a very, very small percentage of that cancer. So that's the situation in lung cancer, where I don't have a percentage, but it's probably less than 1%. But if you do identify these patients, they have really remarkable responses to the currently available NTRK inhibitors. So it's one of those situations where, yes, it's difficult to identify them unless you're doing this kind of broad NGS screening up front for every cancer, but it pays off when you get these amazing responses.
What are some of the other cancers where the NTRK fusions are seen? And I've heard people make analogies to the MSI high situation that's out there right now. You have actually a checkpoint inhibitor approved across tumor lines based on MSI. I've heard people say maybe NTRK's going to go the same way. What other cancers do you see it in? And do you think that people are going to start to view these separately?
We've seen it in rare colorectal cancers, rare pancreatic cancer, rare sarcomas. So it's a rare event, but very targetable. So right now, there's no pathologic feature that would tell you that this lung cancer is likely to have an NTRK fusion. There are, as I mentioned previously, very rare subsets of breast cancer and sarcoma that have NTRK fusions consistently. So secretory breast carcinoma, a very rare subtype, consistently is basically defined by presence of ETV6 NTRK3 fusion. And some congenital fibrosarcomas are also defined by ETV6 NTRK3 fusions. But aside from those very rare tumors, in common cancers, it's quite a rare event.
How about this MSK Impact initiative?
So MSK Impact is a broad NGS assay that we've been running since 2014. Currently, it's a panel of 468 genes that allows us to detect mutations, copy number changes, as well as rearrangements in certain genes. And it has really been extremely powerful at our center to identify comprehensively the targetable alterations and basically enroll as many patients as possible into the trials of targeted therapies at our center.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you've seen up to this point.
So we recently reported our experience with MSK Impact sequencing in the first 860 lung adenocarcinoma patients that were studied. And It gives a very comprehensive picture of targetable alterations. As I mentioned previously, for the alterations that you included in the survey, we're seeing about 35% of patients present with one of these alterations. So it's definitely a very important population of lung adenocarcinoma patients who stand to benefit from this kind of profiling. So there's 35% of patients who can benefit from a drug that's now FDA approved. And then there's probably another 15% that are eligible for drugs that are currently in clinical trials at our institution. So altogether, this makes about 50% of lung adenocarcinoma patients who stand to benefit in one way or another from the MSK impact sequencing. And I should mention another important thing that emerges from the MSK impact sequencing is we get a sense of the tumor mutation burden, which has also emerged as an important predictor of response to immunotherapies. So even if we don't identify a targetable alteration, we are providing information on tumor mutation burden, which can be used to prioritize patients for immunotherapy instead.
Let's talk about tumors with EGFR mutations, and particularly what happens when patients receive an EGFR TKI and then have disease progression.
So for EGFR mutated lung cancer, as you know, the major resistance mechanism to erlotinib and other EGFR kinase inhibitors is the development of a second mutation, T790M. And we're able to detect this in somewhere between 50 to 60% of patients who develop resistance to first-line EGFR TKIs. But we're also able to detect other resistance mechanisms. And the major other resistance mechanisms are MET amplification and ERBB2 amplification. And both of these potentially could be treated, targeted. So this is useful information. We're also still discovering new resistance mechanisms, and there's that work is in progress and is partly based on the MSK impact sequencing.
So just to clarify, because I don't recall hearing that before, you're saying that one of the mechanisms of resistance that develops with patients on TKIs is not only T790, but also MET and HER2?
Yes. So those are what we would call target-independent resistance mechanisms or bypass mechanisms. So you can develop resistance either by having a subclone of cells with this new T790M mutation grow out, which makes the TKI no longer active against the mutant EGFR molecule, or you can develop another alteration, not in EGFR, but in another signaling molecule. So like I said, the most common is MET amplification and ERBB2 amplification, and they're seen in probably 5% of these resistant samples. And in those cases, there's no T790M. The cells have become resistant because they've turned on, they've amplified either MET or ERBB2 and have kind of compensated for the inhibition of EGFR by doing that and increasing the mitogenic MAP kinase signaling back to the level that was there before the EGFR TKI.
How do you manage patients with EGFR mutations with disease progression on a first-line TKI?
So the approach at our place, at least, is to do the T790M testing first on a patient who has a recurrence on EGFR TKI. Do the T790M first, either in plasma DNA or from a biopsy. And then if that's negative, then go on to MSK impact comprehensive testing of the biopsy.
What about the issue of resistance because of transformation to small cell?
Small cell transformation is, I would say, less than 5% of these resistance mechanisms. And it's the kind of mechanism that would get missed if you're just doing a T790M testing on plasma DNA. In terms of histology, it's a very characteristic finding. So if there's a biopsy and there's small cell transformation, I think it will get picked up that way.
Can you provide your perspective on T790 testing nowadays, both in terms of serum as well as tissue?
Well, I think T790M testing in plasma DNA is probably the most widely used plasma DNA molecular assay. And I believe it's becoming pretty standard at most centers. It can give you a quick answer on whether a patient is progressing due to T790M. And one of the advantages of plasma DNA testing is that it may give you information on every site of disease. So if a patient is progressing at more than one site, the plasma DNA is presumably derived from every site, and therefore you would know that there's at least one of these sites is a recurrence due to T790M. But in terms of going looking at other mechanisms, you still need to get a biopsy to get a good understanding of other mechanisms of resistance in that patient. So one of the interesting things that's been observed with patients who receive osimertinib, which is EGFR TKI that is active in patients who have the T790M mutation that has made them resistant to erlotinib, for instance. These patients, in a subset of cases, develop progression on osimertinib because they've acquired yet another mutation that now inhibits the binding of osimertinib to the mutant EGFR, and that mutation is C797S. And we saw such a patient, we saw one of the first patients like that, and this was a patient who had developed a T790M on erlotinib, was switched to osimertinib, and then developed the C797S and progressed on osimertinib. You can see that originally her EGFR gene did not have either the T790M or C797S. It did have an EGFR exon 19 deletion. And then in 2011, when she progressed on erlotinib, she had the T790M mutation. And by 2014, when she progressed on osimertinib, she had an additional mutation in the same, in addition to the T790M mutation, she had the C797S mutation, which abolished the binding of osimertinib. So it does make you feel like these kinase inhibitors can be a moving target with resistance mechanisms kind of developing almost inevitably. But they do, of course, provide extra years of good quality survival.
Another question about, I've heard people discuss the situation where a patient maybe has a bone met that's hard to get to, some other site that's difficult to get tissue on. A patient who, you know, has responded, now progressed again on EGFR TKI, trying to figure out how hard to look for tissue, and a patient who's T790 negative on serum. And I've heard people say that they look to see whether the original, let's say, exon 14 or whatever mutation is there. And if it is there and you don't see T790, then, quote, you can believe the serum. Can you talk about that sort of thinking?
Well, I think interpreting a negative result on plasma DNA is very tricky because it can either mean there's no T790M, or it can mean that for whatever reason, the tumor cells did not shed DNA, sufficient amount of DNA into the blood to be detectable. So I think a negative plasma DNA result is not something you can really act on.
Another question about T790 is, I've heard that there are actually people with T790 germline mutations. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it was discovered several years ago that the T790M can occur as a germline mutation and that it's associated with an increased risk of lung adenocarcinoma. So these are families in which there's a high rate of lung cancer unrelated to smoking. And so this, I would say it's probably less than 1% of patients that have this germline T790M, but it's something that could explain in a patient. why there's T790M detected at diagnosis before any exposure to TKIs. That patient who has a germline T790M and has developed lung adenocarcinoma would show essentially primary resistance to EGFR TKI. There's also another very small subset of patients that have an acquired T790M, not germline, acquired, but it's present at diagnosis before any TKI. And we don't know exactly why that is, but it's also been observed. Again, maybe 1% of patients or less.
Can you talk about ALK fusions and challenges in making the diagnosis?
Detecting ALK fusions can be done by several different approaches, starting with immunohistochemistry. So it turns out that ALK is not normally expressed in most tissues at a level that could be detected by immunohistochemistry. But when it's involved in a fusion in lung cancer, for instance, the expression is ramped up to such a degree that you can pick it up with the antibody. And it's really a very, very robust, you know, biomarker. Then there's FISH, as I mentioned, which tells you that there's been a rearrangement of the ALK gene using a break-apart FISH assay. Then there are a variety of NGS assays, either DNA-based or RNA-based, that can detect ALK fusions. And they can be designed so that you don't need to know the partner that is fused to ALK. So you're able to pick up an ALK fusion regardless of what the other gene that ALK is fused to is.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, results from the Phase 3 FLORA study were presented at ESMO, demonstrating that osimertinib significantly improved progression-free survival compared to standard of care EGFR TKIs in patients with EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special CME program focusing on a survey of clinical investigators in lung cancer.